I don't want to care. If I care about things, it'll just be worse. It'll just be another thing to worry about. It's less painful if I don't care. Clay, less than zero. Hello, I'm Kennedy Weibel.
And I'm Rebecca Capone.
And this is Reading Pop Classics, the podcast where we read and discuss current era classics, books that had a major cultural impact and whose resonance is still felt today. And today we're discussing Bret Easton Ellis's 1985 debut novel, Less Than Zero. The story of the creation of this book and how it came to be is almost as famous as the book itself. He was still in college. He had been taking several literature classes, and he'd been working on this since I think he was in high school. It started out as diary entries, things he was trying to formalize that he had written when he was younger, and he brought it to one of his professors, Joe McGinnis, at Bennington College, where he was a student. And together they worked on it. Joe McGinnis offered editorial advice. We're going to talk about that and how Joe McGinnis's work on this book with Bret Easton Ellis when he's, I think, a junior or sophomore, how it influenced the style of it. But Joe McGinnis works with him to get this down into the novel that we have today, puts him in touch with an agent, and helps him get it published while he is still a student. And it's not an immediate smash hit. It comes out in the spring of 1985, I believe. But by that fall, word of mouth has kind of spread. The notoriety of the book has gotten out in certain circles, and I think it's when the paperback comes out in the fall that it really takes off. So, Rebecca, do you want to start us off as we usually do? Does it pass the Bechdel test?
It
This
does pass
book
the Bechdel.
written by a 20-year-old young man in the 80s?
A 20-year-old rich white man in the 80s. It does actually pass the Bechdel test, and it scrapes by a little bit, but there are conversations between like Blair and Kim and the other, girls he's friends with, and even between his unnamed sisters, that do talk about something besides a man. Of course, everything they talk about is sort of fluff, as it were, but that is kind of the
But
point of the book. There,
everything
there.
everyone, we're going to dissect it a little
I
bit, but
was
everything
gonna say
everyone talks about in this book is fluff.
exactly. It's not like the male characters are having these really deep conversations, and the girls are only talking about, getting their nails done. But yeah, no one in this conversation has, in this book has very deep conversations, but it does pass the Bechdel test because
Would you say,
he does include. There are a lot of women in this book.
yeah, I would say it passes, I would say, better than a predominantly female book like Valley of the Dolls that we did.
That I had to really search to find conversations to make it past the Bechdel test. That's true.
And the conversations that the Bechdel test measures or takes into consideration, I guess it doesn't officially measure them, but that it takes into consideration are, one of them is like, do two female characters talk? Do they talk about something other than a man? The point of talking specifically about a partner, a romantic partner, applies to the men in this book as well. Like, I think the men in this particular novel, when they're having their dumb conversations, they're as likely to be about a partner, romantic or sexual partner, as the female characters are.
Yeah.
Like, that feels weighted pretty evenly. It's not something that specifically lands on the female characters in this one.
Yeah, I agreed. I agree with that.
So this is, I've read this book maybe half a dozen times at this point. It is, I will say, saying that, it makes it sound like this is one of my favorite books of all times. It's not necessarily that, but it is an affecting book and it's 200 pages. Like, you can read it really easily.
It
It's sort
does
of the
fly by.
way, it's sort of the way I've seen Billy Madison, the movie, a lot. It's not necessarily that Billy Madison is my favorite movie. It's just super easy to watch. Goes down real easy. Doesn't require a lot. It's like 90 minutes. This is kind of that equivalent. Like, it's a super easy read.
It is an easy read, and I do think that they're, I do think a lot of people sort of enjoy this sort of like jaded rich kid genre, right? We're interested in how the other half lives, as it were.
And I think he.
There's always TV, there's always movies, there are books a lot of times, do kind of cover this subject matter of these poor little rich people and their rich problems and stuff. I think that's something that people have an interest in. I think one, just because it's not, I mean, most of us don't live in they're the 1% for a reason, like, right? Most of us didn't grow up in mansions with parents that worked in Hollywood and bought us all of these fancy cars and didn't pay any attention to us. Most people don't have that level of money, and the problems. And then I think also maybe there's just that like Schadenfreude, of seeing that somebody who has all of this stuff, still has these problems, or like, well, their problems are worse than yours. So I do feel like this is kind of like a popular genre, and I do think that's like also a re th that is also like, I think maybe one of those things that goes into like reading this book or reading it a few times, is to kind of like be like exist in that world that seems so like alien probably to the rest of us.
I would say that he is also the originator of the sort of glamorous nihilism theme of wealthy, wealthy youngsters. Like the show Euphoria feels like there's a straight line between less than zero and Euphoria.
Yeah, I'll cop to that. And even I mean, Gossip Girl is what came to mind for me.
Yeah, I would say that
Yeah.
that one's related. That one has
One
a
of my
little
guilty
bit, that one's a little
pleasures.
soapier,
It's
if I recall.
soapier for sure,
But
but the characters,
that show Skins.
but Chuck Bass is like speaking of Gossip Girl specifically, but Chuck Bass is a nihilistic character, right? Like he's somebody who is like sort of fundamentally unhappy and damaged, and has all this money, and he's I think pretty nihilistic. He doesn't seem to have these like high hopes for himself and his life. He just kind of drowns himself in the things that he has, and he's not a very happy person.
Let's talk about the plot quickly. This book begins with our main character and our narrator, Clay, lands back in Los Angeles at LAX. He is home for Christmas break from college. He goes to a college that he calls Camden. In the book, that is very clearly just we know at this point is Bennington College, where Bret Easton Ellis went. Clay is back from Camden out east, back in LA. His ex question mark girlfriend, Blair, picks him up at the airport, drives him home, and he's home for approximately 4 weeks. For most of the 4 weeks, Clay just drives around, seeing people, going to parties, watching television. He doesn't do a lot. There's a little bit of a plot centering around his friend Julian, who he's looking for in the beginning. When he catches up with him, Julian borrows some money. When Clay wants it back, Julian takes him to the pimp who Julian's been working for as a young man whore in order to get money to pay down a vaguely alluded to drug debt that this pimp helped him get out of, I suppose, and now he owes the pimp money, and then the book ends. Right? I summed that
I
up pretty.
mean, yeah, pretty much he comes back and takes a look around at how depressing and sad everything is, and is like, I'm gonna go back to the Northeast, where, as we will learn in further Bret Easton Ellis novels, everything is also sad and depressing, but also there's fall and four seasons.
So let's talk about that
But the weather changes.
because this book was really like this book was a splash when it like was a hit when it came out. Not immediately. It took a little while to catch fire, and it took a little while to catch fire with younger readers in particular, I think, put this on the map. Like younger readers who were closer in age to the characters in this book and closer in age in real life to Bret Easton Ellis, the author. But it was reviewed well pr critically. Michiku Kakutani gave it a pretty positive review in the New York Times, and she can be vicious when she feels like it. She doesn't like pull any punches. She gave it a pretty good review, particularly for a debut novel, and I think specifically commented that Bret Easton Ellis had promise and she was looking forward to like what he was going to do next. But it also came out like, and Bret Easton Ellis himself became something of a phenomenon. Him and Jay McInerney, who had also published a novel that was filled with cocaine like this one is around
Bright
the same
Lights,
time
Big
called,
City.
yeah, Bright Lights, Big City. Both of them were made into movies. Both of them were photographed out and about in New York, in LA, at clubs very late at night, looking all elegantly wasted and so forth. And they were kind of dubbed the them and a few others were dubbed the literary brat pack. Back at a time, I should point out, where that was like a thing that could happen. I don't think that like is maybe it could happen today, but I don't know if three authors being out together would make it into the society pages.
Maybe if one of them was Sally Rooney.
I gotta tell you, I
People
don't
love
know.
Rooney.
I mean, I feel like somebody would like thumbs up an Instagram photo, but I don't know that authors are famous the same way now that they.
No, that's true. I think that you have a good point that I think, like, because I mean, because we have social media and there's also so many ways to be famous. Like in the 1980s, you couldn't be famous on YouTube for mashing your face into bread. I bring that up because there's somebody who's literally famous on YouTube. I believe it's a Japanese woman who mushes her face into different kinds of bread, and she makes a lot of money and has millions and millions of followers.
Does it leave an impression of her face? Or she's just whapping her face into a loaf of bread and just like
She,
that's the
yeah,
video.
like, yeah, she puts a loaf of bread on the table and then she mushes her face into it on camera, and it's like different kinds of bread. And she'll be like, oh, today I'm using, a sourdough bull or whatever, and then she mushes her face in it. Yeah, she's made millions of dollars. She's like rich and famous from doing this. And that was not a thing you could do in the 80s. You could make movies or TV, or you could be in movies or TV, or you could write books. You could be a politician, but there's only so many ways to
Sorry,
be, or a model.
and I don't mean to interrupt you, but
Oh, you're we're
does she bake the bread?
I don't think so.
It's just she just acquires bread.
To be clear, I do not watch the videos of the girl who mushes her face into bread. I just was sort of floored to learn through, I don't know, an article or something, that that was a thing that you could be rich and famous for doing. Because I, as a child of the 80s, thought that there were only so many ways to be famous, and that that was to be an actor, a model, politician, or, and I mean, kind of an author. I do feel like that was a little bit more of a thing where you could have some
Yeah.
celebrity. We
No,
only had some.
I was raised in an era where like authors were famous. They went on late night shows and like they talked to Johnny Carson.
Yeah,
They
100%.
talked to David Letterman. Like they
We
were
only.
interviewed the way they were treated with a celebrity that I guess I don't think that it's quite the same level. Like
Well, we only
you
had so
say.
many ways to be entertained then, and now there's a lot of ways to be entertained. You could be TikTok famous, and Instagram influencers
No,
have some
celebrity,
level of
you're
fame, right?
100%
Millions of
right.
people know who they are and what they are wearing every day or whatever it is.
Celebrity has fragmented. So, but this book was a hit and it's still a touchstone. Like not that long ago, I think Quentin Tarantino was entertaining the idea of adapting this again because it's already been turned into a
It's already
movie.
been with Andrew McCarthy.
Andrew McCarthy, Robert Downey Jr., Ione Skye, and James Spader are just some of the hot young stars of the time who were in the adaptation. The adaptation bears very little.
I mean, a movie needs a narrative that this book doesn't have.
Yeah, the movie does not bear a lot of similarity to the book. The characters have the same names. Clay does come back from college, but he comes back. And he's upset because when he was back at Thanksgiving, he found out that Julian and Blair had started a relationship and Blair was cheating on him. And the plot of the book is to sort of get Julian off drugs and save his life. And the character of Rip is the one who is manipulating Julian. It's sort of, there's a little more teen drama around it's still kind of dark. It's still, Julian is just freebasing in that one. And I think Robert Downey Jr.'s not acting. I think it's filmed at a time where they just built a set around whatever Robert Downey Jr. was doing in real life and then filmed it. It's kind
Oh,
of, I don't know.
that's also pretty dark, so that's pretty fitting, I guess, when it comes
It's
down to
back when he was problematic, or to himself mostly.
back before he was Iron Man. Yeah.
It's the pre-Iron Man era. Still in movies, though. But so what is it about this book?
So it has this stream, it has this like stream of consciousness style of writing a little bit, right? Like it's a little bit of just sort of these like unbroken thoughts. We're very much inside this character's, we're very much inside this character's head. So I feel like we're very much inside of this character's life. We're walking around observing the world with him, and that is also what he's doing.
Yeah, it's like a hangout book, kind of. You're just sort of with Clay as he goes around LA.
And he's just sort of hanging out, observing people. They're constantly sort of, you know, like his friends are sort of constantly asking, like, what's up with you? Where are you? What's going on with you?
All of this escalates at the end. I will say the end crescendos into, God, we'll get
So,
to it, but the end builds to like some fairly existentially horrific and physically horrific scenes at the end. The book works for me. Like I don't dislike the book. Like I like reading it, and like those 6 times that I've read it, like the style works for me. This stripped down, observational, like no metaphor, right? Like Clay doesn't observe things being like another thing. He doesn't wax poetic about the moon. He doesn't wax poetic about the desert or anything like that. It's just the moon was out, the moon shone down on the desert in Palm Springs as I drove my car along the road, and then I made a right-hand turn and then a left-hand turn and then two more rights, and then I was at the driveway that my parents and my grandparents and my sisters and myself all stayed at in the summer times when we were out of school and away from work out in Palm Spring. Like it, and it goes on like that. The sentences are a combination
Sentences
of like
seemingly
very
run into
short,
each other.
very run-on, very short, run on short, run on short. This, like, it's rhythmic in a way. And even though nothing happens, I
The
don't
writing
mind.
is a little bit lulling, like when he describes driving around.
Yeah.
Like he's driving around late at night, smoking a cigarette, listening to music, kind of aimlessly driving. And there's a rhythm. There's like a sense of like lulling to that, I think, is like young people too, when you have that, like there's that new freedom of driving too.
Yeah.
Also, you're young, so you can see at night, and driving at night isn't stressful like it is when you're older and you don't see as well. And there's like the glare, right? Like there's like this lulling sense, and I feel like that's his writing too. Is like we're meant to sort of feel that. We're sort of meant to feel that way, right? Like we're sort of meant to feel, like you said, that this is kind of a hangout book. We're sort of a fly on the wall, and that's him as well. And something that I noticed throughout this book. So you and I talked about this off screen, as it were, you know, prior to starting. The first Freddy Sinelis book I read was Less Than Zero, and I have read probably most of I've read most of his body of work. There's maybe one or two that have escaped me, and as has been discussed before in this podcast, I could absolutely not finish The Shards, and I have zero regret about putting that book down.
Let's table that for a moment because I
But we'll
want to
come back
talk
to
about
it.
the shards. Yeah,
We'll
for
come back to The
me.
Shards, but as discussed, you know, was the one I couldn't finish. But I've read a majority of his things. I've liked a majority of his things. But now I've kind of come full circle back to this book, because this is only the second time I've read this. I do think I saw the movie, actually. But this is only the second time I've read this book. But like I said, I have kind of come full circle now, having read his other stuff and come back to this. And I see that he's drawing on the same things, the same themes, the same elements in all of his books. And some of those things are, there is this ominous feeling in his writing. So it is a little bit
Yes.
of, we are sort of like lulled, right? Like we're sort of lulled, like I said, kind of like this like nighttime driving that he describes in the book. Like that's a little bit this style of writing, that we're sort of like lulled, we're observing, we're watching. We don't have a lot of maybe emotion about what's happening with our characters in this book, and the people around him, right? Like I don't feel super connected to these other characters. But I'm interested in what they're doing. I'm interested in sort of like watching and observing their
And there is somehow a tension going
there is a
on while there's
tension.
nothing happening.
He's describing like the Elvis Costello poster he is describing in the beginning is watching him and making him feel uncomfortable. There's just, scenes he describes in Palm Springs, like when he goes back into those little like reveries that like, like the grandfather is hearing things at night, the dog is barking, the dog is upset about something. The next day there's a pack of Lucky Strikes, like an empty pack of Lucky Strikes on the property. Nobody smokes.
But
And then
nobody
like,
smokes those.
but nobody smokes. And nobody checks it out. Nobody figures out what it is. It's not mentioned again. It's this ominous sense. He mentions driving in the desert, driving in Palm Springs late at night, one of his like late night drives, and he gets nervous and he's looking in the rear view. And there's a lot of kind of things like that described in the book. A little later in the book, Blair hits a coyote with the car, and we get a little bit of this like Stephen King-esque, or like what we'll see later in American Psycho or in The Shards.
100% was
We
what,
start
yes,
to
you
get that
can.
like that gruesome, we get like a gruesome description of her hitting the coyote and what, and he has to like get the coyote out from under the car. So we get kind of this gruesome scene. The novel's very sexual, like there's a lot of sex in the book, but something that's interesting is a lot of it happens off screen.
Let's also talk about the fact that a
It's not
lot of
super
it
detailed.
is that it is not heteronormative. A lot of it is gay sex.
A lot of it is, yeah.
For 1985, a 20-year-old kid, this book is very like queer progressive.
Right, because we're not talking, because what we're not focused on is like, oh, it's gay sex. Oh, I was attracted to a man and that's this or that.
It's so flat.
They're all just having sex with each other. That's just what's going on. That's just what's going on. They're just all there. They're just all, their parents don't care about them. Nobody's parents are around. No one's parents are paying attention. They've all been, addicted to drugs and alcohol or using drugs and alcohol as an escape for years and having sex with each other. And there's not this talk of like, oh, they're gay or they're straight. They don't know if they're together with people or not. And you're right, that is incredibly progressive for
Progressive in the sense that just
1985.
they're in the book, that it is not remarked upon, that there is
Right.
no, I don't know, somebody's homophobia is not a plot point. Like it's, I
He's
think there's probably.
not concerned or trying to hide the fact that he's got this ex-girlfriend that they have this sort of question, it's questionable maybe what's happening between them.
And I think, so if we could
And
stop
she,
there for a second, I just
yes.
wanted to, that's one of the things. So, because none of the characters ever actually really discuss anything, like you can tell there's things they want to say to one another, but they never actually come right out and say anything. That they don't challenge one another, they don't resolve anything. But because there's this like Clay's clear bisexuality in the book, because it's never remarked upon in any other way, and it doesn't factor in, you start taking those pieces and wondering, you start applying them to scenes. Like you start wondering if some of the, because it's not, you don't get told at any point what the tension between Clay and Blair might be. Is it that Clay is gay and Blair wants him to like say that he's gay, say that he's not gay, make a decision? Like, is that one of the things that's going on between them? You never really know. And because you never get it addressed in the narrative or by any of the characters, you can pull these other things from the book into every conversation. And you start wondering if that's an underlying thing that's going on in this otherwise what appears to be a meaningless scene. You start applying meaning from other aspects of the book.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do think you're meant to pull in, because again, you're
Like,
this kind of fly in the wall. So it's like if you were to step into a group of friends, like I don't know, you go to like a coworker's wedding or something, and so you meet their college friends, and like they have their own dynamics, and you're sitting at a table with them, and you're the one who's like observant and sort of pulling meaning into their conversations and into like their memories and stuff they're talking about. And we are doing that in this book a little bit.
Like when Clay goes over to Rip's apartment and all the guys are sort of half dressed, hanging out. Some of them have clearly been hooking up with one another. Like, is this what the problem with Blair is? Like, is it Clay's part of this world? Or is Clay just there and it's just going on? Like, you don't really ever get it addressed. Like the couple times where he flashes back, like he seems like kind of preoccupied with what's going on with Julian. Like if he has any kind of preoccupation in the book, it's that. He's not really concerned about anything else except getting more cocaine. But his sort of preoccupation with like Julian, like has anyone seen him? Has anyone heard from him? You are left to wonder, does it like he have some kind of relationship with Julian? Left
Right.
unresolved,
Is
left,
this
when he
somebody?
went out east and now he's trying to catch up with him and like he just sees that this guy's fallen
Is this
just
just someone who was a
into
really
this.
was is this just someone who was a really good friend? Is this someone that he had a romantic relationship with? Like, yeah, like he doesn't seem to care about much. Why does he care about this person so much?
Yes,
And then in the end,
and let's temper that so much with like it's just the only person he seems to
and it's also like
he
there's
cares
also.
about him on some pages and on some pages you never it's not a thing.
Well, and it's like he catches up with everybody else, and it's meaningless. Like he comes back, and everyone else that he catches up with, it's just the same stuff.
Julian is the only person who seems to have something new going on.
Julian's the
It's
only person that
horrific,
has something
but
new going on. Julian's the only person he kind of can't like pin down to have one of these meaningless conversations with, to just be like, oh, everything here is meaningless.
that's true.
And then Julian is the only one that he can't quite pin down. When he does pin him down, Julian is like, anxious, doesn't have time for him, isn't meeting his eye. He asks him for money and he won't tell him why. Whereas everyone else is kind of upfront about like how screwed up they are, or like,
No, that's true. Julian also is the only person who has anything going on for Clay to be like curious about. He's the only source of curiosity.
everyone else just comes out with their problems. Their problems are like, my coke dealer's not calling me back. My this I kind of like this girl and we're not going.
I can't find any meth.
I can't find the guy who can't find meth, who
The
keeps
guy
asking
who can't
everybody
find
for
meth is the
meth.
funniest part of the book for me. Like it's not. There's like little scenes every now and again where like the exchanges are kind of funny, but like to me, it's not a particularly funny novel except for the guy who can't find meth. And then
The guy who can't find meth, and then the fact that everybody, the other thing that I enjoy, that I think is funny, is like in the beginning, everyone keeps telling him like, he's pale. You're so pale.
yes, that actually is pretty funny. I like
And
that
then
too.
like maybe halfway through the book, someone finally is like, oh, nice tan. And then his tan gets mentioned for like the rest of the book. Like, I love that it keeps coming back. Because I love that they keep being like, oh, you're so pale, as though they like don't know that seasons exist other places.
No, it's a very LA thing. Like
Of
that
course
actually,
I'm
you're
pale.
right.
He
That is
lives in
very
New
funny.
Hampshire. I've been in New Hampshire for months. It's
In the
cold there.
winter.
In the winter. Yeah,
Yeah.
it's January. It's December. It's January. But
I
so
also, but like the guy who can't find meth over like two or three little more sections go by. And then in one of the points where he's looking for Julian, he calls a house asking for him. And the guy who answers is like, hey, by the way, do you have any meth? Who is this? And do you have any meth? It
yeah.
calls back later.
I do like that I appreciated that it called back a little while later. But so what we were talking about with like his writing, again, there's like, there is a lot of sex in this book, but it's not particularly explicit. There aren't very many like explicit sex scenes. Everything
No.
kind of happens off screen. Like, things happen more or less off screen sexually. We do have the scene with the coyote. We have the scene with the coyote that's like a little gruesome, and those I think are the So there's that, and then he does, and then there are things that are shocking in this book. So like there's a not graphic, but we do get a description of like a snuff film, essentially.
Yeah. And we get enough of it to be upset.
We get enough of it for it to be upsetting. And then I think the most upsetting thing that I don't even want to spend a lot of time talking about is there's the young girl
The gang rape,
that's tied to the bed. Yes.
who's been drugged.
Who's been drugged, and then
It is
they're all participating in it, and Clay has to like leave the room.
unclear how she got there.
And again, we do not get the it's not incredibly explicit, but it is incredibly like it is an incredibly shocking and upsetting thing. And
I do
that,
want to
I
talk
think, is
about it
what
for a little bit just because it is. I don't want to delve into it, but that scene is foreshadowing for like, again, like American Psycho, because the scene makes no logical sense whatsoever in the context of the book's world or plot or machinations. He's out with all the people who come back to that apartment where that girl is. He's been with them forever and it hasn't been brought up, and like Rip is sort of like, oh, snaps his fingers. I got a thing to show you. Come back to my place. And this
Well, it's after they
incredibly
see the dead
elaborate.
guy in the alley, right? Like they leave this bar because it's like, oh, like let's go see this guy, and it's a guy in, who's OD'd or something, I
Yeah.
guess,
And they're
in
all
an
laughing about
alley,
it. And they put a
and they're
cigarette in his
laughing
mouth.
about it. Nobody they're laughing about it. They put a cigarette in his mouth. Nobody thinks to be No one thinks to call the cops. This is somebody's son, right? I mean, not to
And we
be
can tell that people have been hearing about it and coming to see him and
and
leaving and
coming to
telling
see
other
him,
people. He's been there for a while.
and it's these rich people that's like, you're not. Someone's looking for this person, probably, right? I mean, I'd like to think, I guess, like not to be, I don't know, not to be Midwestern Nancy over here, but like this is somebody's son or brother.
Yeah, no, somebody wants to know where he is.
Somebody wants to know where he is. They should know. There should be some dignity. There should be some dignity in death, for this person. And they're laughing about it.
And then that scene is Trump, though, because while they're doing it, Rip goes, "Hang on, I got something even crazier to show you." And they go back to his apartment where this 12-year-old girl is tied up, being fed heroin and being gang raped in her heroin-induced, I don't know what it's called when you're on heroin. You're
You're on the
lethargy.
nod.
Yeah, when
Yeah.
you're on the nod, you're heroin-induced lethargy. But the way those scenes in American Psycho start piling up, where you're just sort of like, hang on, how did you get 12 bodies out of this apartment and no one saw, like from the 20th floor and no one saw you? Like that, like where the logic breaks down. And in
Right.
American Psycho, it big because of the ending, it feels like that is baked in, where you were meant to question how much of this is in his head, how much of this is real, is any of it real, is any of it in his head? You're is it because the description, is it just the writing that makes you question it and it's all real, or is the writing a clue that it's not? And that particular scene this time, I realized, was like a look at what was coming from Bret Easton Ellis with his most notorious book, American Psycho, because there's Rip hasn't mentioned this in 6 pages, and just they go back to his apartment where this is there. There's no like logical way that this was he like forgot to tell people
He
about
forgot to
this.
tell people. He just like left. Was just like, oh, I'm gonna leave my apartment, even though I have, I've, even though I've conducted a kid rap a kidnapping, as a child, that
I
he's
mean,
got there. I mean, that's kind of a major thing to just be like, I guess I'll just go out with my friends and laugh around for a little bit. Oh yeah, I forgot. I have this thing I want to show you.
I get the feel, like I get the sense that like he didn't like snatch a kid off the street, that like this girl was hanging out with him, like.
Yeah, probably. No, I mean, probably. That's a good point. But yes, to your point of like, yeah, he just like forgets about it for a little bit and then invites all of his friends back.
That's also the scene, and I again, it's a terrible scene, of course, and but it's this crescendo. Like we've gone with Clay, where Julian gets pimped out to this guy who has it, it's one of the times that time is described as something like 5 hours of sex with him.
Right.
Like they come out of that hotel room, like he says it's like
He
four
says that it's
hours
been
later or
four or
five
five
hours later.
hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have the dead guy scene following that. The snuff film is in there, or the snuff film is in this
It's in this
ending
portion
too.
of the books towards the
It's been a
ending of the
little bit
book.
bland. Like they've been doing drugs and they've been emotionally numb for most of it. And then in this last third,
It
not
is
even the
around the
full last
time that you
third.
start to be a little bit bored for him, of just like, oh God, yeah, I would also just like want to go back to school. This
It gets
sucks.
grim real quick at the
And then
end.
it gets, I mean, the whole book is grim, as again, something you and I kind of discussed off camera. This is an easy book to get through, but there were some times when I was reading this book that it would be like, it's not that I don't have time to keep reading, but I don't want to. I want to put this down for a little bit
But that
and
scene is
go look at
also,
something nice.
yeah, that scene is also where we realize that Clay is not, we can sort of wonder throughout the book if Clay's aloofness is because he feels morally detached from what's going on in this book and he doesn't like it. And he's looking down on these things and like wishing he wasn't a part of it, but doesn't know how. As the reader, you can tell yourself that until we have the scene with the girl. And Clay has an outburst for a second where he's like, "Rip, what the hell? Like, this is why are you doing this? You can't do this, man. That girl's 11." And Rip goes, "Hey, she's 12." And Clay stops for a second and goes, "Yeah, 12. Like, it makes a difference." And he's like, "Oh, Clay's not in any way morally above this. Like, he's not participating in a
He
lot of it."
doesn't participate in it. What's the expression? that it's like a good man who says nothing.
I don't know, the evil man. I don't know. I feel like it's probably something about like you're a bad person for not saying things. And I'm assuming that the expression points to the fact that if you don't stop a bad thing, you're just as bad as the people who are
Right.
doing it or
So
something to that effect.
the morally correct decision here is to leave the room and call the police.
Oh yeah.
That's what we do in this situation, right?
In several of the situations Clay finds himself
this
in,
is what I would
calling the
do in this
police
situation. I would leave and call
and
the police.
yeah, maybe some religious figures, like I don't know, possibly a fireman, EMTs, anyone,
Legitimately
like,
anybody, yes, but to just be like, I'm going to leave because like I don't like what's going on. But I'm just going to stand here and let this happen.
Oh, he's, yeah, no, he's a, that's the, I mean, it's just, the snuff film is a film. There's not a lot he can do about that. The dead guy in the alley is already dead. There's not a lot he can do about that.
This is something where he can
He
take
could,
action
yes.
and he doesn't.
Yes.
So that's the thing. We kind of talk about like, there's this tenseness, there's this ominousness, and then yes, like to use your word, it does just like crescendo at the end of the book with these just like really horrific.
The curtain's pulled all the way back
The
to the
curtain is
actual
pulled all the
horror.
way back, exactly around the time that we're sort of bored with these like these numb children who aren't cared for and don't really care for each other, and just kind of bury themselves in drugs and each other, on a surface level. Then we have all this stuff at the end. So we have this kind of tension throughout the book, but it is like in reading the book this time, it was like almost like he's too young to really delve into, like he's too young to really be comfortable going into these sex scenes, to really be comfortable getting so like gruesome and detailed. And then he really hits his stride for American Psycho, where it's like he's famous enough from Less Than Zero to be like, yeah, y'all thought that was bad. You have zero idea where my mind can go.
So let's, is there anything else particularly you want to say about the plot of the novel? Because I would like to talk about Bret Easton Ellis, him,
I do,
the
yes,
author
I do
also.
have one
Like,
more thing that I want to
yeah,
swing
okay.
back into, that I want to swing back into American Psycho, and that is at the end of the book, his conversation with Blair. Hold just a moment.
So I will add while you're looking for that, the style of this book, though, I think, so despite like the either non-existent plot or the lurid subject matter when it does come up. The reportorial? I don't know if I've ever said that word out loud. The reportorial sort of journalistic style of just like like flat observation, like just reporting like the things that Clay sees really does work. Like it is, I don't think that this book is just the shock value at the end. I think it's better than just young people feeling cool for not caring. Like, I think
Oh,
it's.
agreed. Yeah, I do. No, I agree with you. I do think that because it is, and I love that journalistic style of writing. We've talked about that in some other things that we've
Yeah.
read. I do like that just very matter of fact, kind of straightforward reporting where there's not a ton of like opinion or judgment that's coming from him really.
And I don't think that this is a great book, but I think that it's a good book. I think that the fact that it's very short, and we'll talk about this when we get to when we get to the shards, but or I guess we'll just br I'll bring it up now. But like in the shards, this goes on for 700 pages, and you start to realize how hollow it is, and that it doesn't mean anything, and that there is no deeper substance to the book. It is all style. This one is short enough that you don't realize that there's nothing to it. You can find perhaps something that it might mean, that it's because they've been left parentless essentially in wealth, and they have devolved into a sort of primal state where like they no longer have feelings or empathy for people. Or you can read it as,
Very Lord of the, it's like kind of Lord of the
you can
Flies.
read it as a Lord of the Flies sort of style book. You can also read it as just pure derealization, like the excesses of the world has just peeled back the, like the kids just don't see anything as being realistic, and like they've lost all sense of reality just because of the excesses of the world around them at large. Because it's short and because it's quick and because the style is good, you can ascribe some meanings to it that you might want to put on it, and probably even write a decent paper justifying why they're there. because you and I have both read the shards, we know there is nothing there because he does it for 700 pages in the shards and there's nothing there. It is
Oh
just,
no,
it's just style.
I went maybe into 300 and was just like, yeah, it was just like this, and this is nothing, and I don't want to finish it. I remember I, as discussed again on this podcast, I will very, very rarely not finish a book. I will hate read something
Yeah.
till the very last page. And the shards was, and again, like I kind of like I said with this book, you know, I've full circled Bret Easton Ellis with Less Than Zero. I started with Less Than Zero. I've read again the majority of the other things he's written. And most recently, about halfway through the shards, and couldn't put it, you know, couldn't get back to it. I read this, and it was, and again, like I'm with you. This is a good book.
Yeah, you could also read it as like these kids have been stripped of emotions in a way that they can't connect with one another. Like he can't get to Julian and the feelings that he has for him, or he can't manage to make the connection with Blair and the feelings that he has for her. The fact that he spends enough time kind of in the past thinking about his parents and his grandparents and all of their family vacations out in Palm Desert or Palm Springs or whatever the place it is that people, rich people in LA go.
Palm Springs.
Yeah, that there's like a sort of loss of innocence from like the death of like the true patriarch of the family, who was his grandfather, and like we see the kind of like meaningless man that his father is. Like you could put all of this into this book because it's only 208 pages long. And maybe all this adds up
Yes.
to something, or that you at least as a reader, you can take something with you when you're done with it. And let's but go
Well,
what's the last
so what
thing
I
you
wanted
wanted to say about it?
to So the last thing I kind of wanted to say, actually I do have one more thing, but anyways, but how I wanted to kind of circle it back to, again, kind of we're talking about like how his writing builds on this book, right?
Yeah.
Like we see this, like I said, like reading this, it's like now I'm looking at like all these other little pieces that he expands on. He expands on you know, the gruesomeness, describing things in horrid detail. He's far more sexual. Like the sex stops happening off screen. He's far more detailed about that. But you know, we kind of do famously know the end of American Psycho. You know, what is this all in his brain? Like, has any of this happened? So in the end of this book, you know, he meets with Blair. Blair wants to have a conversation with him, and she's asking him if he ever really, you know, loved her, and he tells her no. He tells her no, and I don't think that's
I
true.
don't think it's true.
I don't think that's true. I think that he just can't admit to it. These aren't people that can talk. I don't think these are people that can truly talk about their feelings, and that's something I want to come back to. But he asks her, like, you know, did you ever love me? And from here, she pauses. I thought about it, and yeah, I did once. I mean, I really did. Everything was all right for a while. You were kind. She looks down and then goes on, but it was like you weren't there. Oh shit, this isn't going to make any sense. She stops. I look at her, waiting for her to go on, looking up at the billboard, disappear here. I don't know if any other person I've been with has been really there either, but at least they tried. You never did. Other people made an effort, and you just, it was beyond you. You were never there. I felt sorry for you for a little while, but then I found it hard to. You're a beautiful boy, Clay, but that's about it. And we, you know, so he mentions the disappear here billboard that comes up throughout the book.
I
And
like that.
so we have a
I like that
little
last
bit.
line from Blair. I almost used it as the opening quote, but I thought we should have
You're a
one.
beautiful
I
boy,
thought we should have
Clay.
one from Clay, since, and mine is from the same scene where he says, "I don't want to care. I don't want to care about things,"
Right.
which is in some ways the crux of the novel, I suppose. The like leaning into apathy and nihilism, like so that you don't get hurt.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with that. But I also think that, like, you're not really here. He keeps seeing that billboard throughout the
Yeah.
book, disappear here, you're not really here. And it has a little bit of that American Psycho feeling that he's just drifting through. Like, people are looking at him and seeing through him throughout this book.
I think that it works better in American Psycho. It is.
It certainly does. You know, we're not meant here to think like, did all of this really
No,
happen?
I
But it is, we get to this end, and it is like, this is being, it's why he's able to del it's like why he's able to deliver this reportorial
Yeah.
style of writing about his friends and his family and like the people that ostensibly should mean the most to him because this is his home and his background.
It's
This
all.
is where he came from and made him who he is.
It's also the part, though, that I think gives away the fact that, like, this was written by an 18, 19, 20-year-old. Like, I think it's the
It's young.
childish part of the book where he's just sort of like, I don't want to care. I don't want to be hurt again. Like, shut up. You broke up with one girl.
You have so much more hurt. You have so much more hurt coming your way.
Also, like, another tell is the, like, I'm back. I've been gone for so long, but I'm back in my. It's your home for Christmas break at college, Clay. You've been away for since I'm going to presume Thanksgiving. Or let's say that you stayed at Bennington.
Let's say you, yeah, even then, since September,
Yeah, it's a semester, brother.
you go to school in the Northeast. College
Yes.
starts after Labor
The
Day.
fact that he seems so shocked that the city's still there and like my rooms as I left it, like, yeah, dude, you went. It's a semester. You haven't been gone that long. You
Right.
saw these people at the end of last summer. It's just not that long. And that's a, but that's kind of the give. I don't know. That's one of the things where I read it now and I'm like, when I read this when I was like 23, I was, that meant something to me where I was like, yeah, no, you go away, you come back. Now I'm sort of like, you should, all right, man, you weren't gone. You've been gone for just a little tiny bit.
I did also have that, like, yeah, when I was reading the beginning of this, and yes, oh, my room's the same. And it's just like, yeah, of course it's the same. You were there 3 months
Yeah, you were
ago.
just here. You might have even been here at Thanksgiving. What are you?
Yeah, your parents have the money to fly you back and forth. You
Yeah, like.
probably came home at Thanksgiving. Yeah. So, and then I guess maybe one more thing I wanted to point out in the writing is around the dialogue and how there's all of these like all of these pauses and quiet spaces are described in the conversations. Like the dialogue in this feels very the dialogue in this is very good. The dialogue in this feels pretty, it feels pretty true. These hollow conversations, like the way the conversation flows, I think is kind of incredible for somebody who's this young.
Yeah, I would, me reading it,
But
I would
all of these
agree.
like
When we get to the
pauses
one
and like
star reviews, we will find out that not everybody feels
not everybody thinks
that
that, but I mean, I think so because the conversations aren't meant to be deep. This is what wish-wash conversations sound like when you're on drugs and drinking at parties and at bars with people. But he describes these like all of there's pauses, there's quiet, there's dead space that is described in the majority of these conversations. And I think is it that way of describing that like these people don't connect with each other.
No, and he leaves in the parts where people aren't listening. What?
Yes.
Wait, did you say something? And then the other person's like, never mind. And you're like, that might frustrate some readers, but like, I sort of enjoy, and again, because it's like short in this book, like it's used to effect, because the whole book doesn't go on that long, and no one scene lasts all that long.
Yes, if this was a 300, if this was a 300 to 500 page novel of this, I think that would have gotten old. I think the dialogue would get
Well,
old,
so
but again, it works for this.
it's interesting
But
you
yeah,
bring that
I think it's
up.
just there to kind of highlight that these people don't have real conversations. They don't connect with each other. They don't trust each other. They're not like they're thrown together by circumstance. They're thrown together by circumstance and substance use and the fact that they're all sort of in this same boat, but like they don't care about each other. He
No.
doesn't even name his sisters. He doesn't know anything about them.
Nope.
He lives in a ha You grew up with them. You've been away from them for 3 months. You don't know anything about them.
No, they're. Although I think they're used just as far as we're talking about siblings. The fact that he doesn't name them and doesn't seem to have any connection to them is used with better effect in this book than Bridget Jones's brother is in Bridget Jones' Diary, which I didn't bring up in our last episode. But why is the brother even in the book?
Oh yeah, it's a good
It's like
point. I
two
know he's
scenes for
not
no. Like a
for
vestigial
nothing.
leftover from the newspaper articles, I'm presuming. But
Yeah.
it's interesting that you say you bring up a 300 to 500 page version of this. So that's what this was to begin with, was Bret Easton Ellis had been working on this in one form or another since he was maybe 16, 15, 16. Some of it was diary entries that he was trying to turn into something. Some of it was just like writing exercises, but he had this very long, long version of this. And his professor, Joe McGinnis, who's also an author, just shredded it, just cut it all back. He did two major things to the book, and this is according to Bret Easton Ellis. He got him to switch from third person to first person. Bret Easton Ellis had written it in first person originally, had moved it to third person because he didn't want it to seem like it was him or that the people were people he knew. And Joe McGinnis was like, "No, it has to go back to first person. It's stronger that way." And he talked him into changing it back to the eye narration. And then he just shredded it and cut it back, cut it back, cut it back till it's this like light, slim volume that you see here, 200 pages lighter than what Bret Easton Ellis had turned in. And Bret Easton Ellis like worked with him on the edits and stuff for this, but it cemented his style, like the style that he was copying from, not copying, that doesn't sound, that's mean, because authors have influences. But you've read Play It As It Lays, and he's talked about this, but like he very much was channeling Joan Didion and the way Joan Didion writes and the way she particularly writes about California when he was writing this. And like one of his like literary heroes and a stylist that he admired. So Joe McGinnis cuts this back and gives us this instant classic. Like it was notorious immediately when it came out. It was critically well regarded. It was on bestseller lists. They made it into a movie. Like it still persists. When I was in my late 20s, I would meet people who were just discovering this book, people who didn't really read. Like this book is still out there and it's still influencing things like we talked about, like Euphoria. And then, so then he writes Rules of Attraction while he's still in college, right?
Which takes place at Bennington.
That's actually my
Or
favorite.
well, I mean, it takes place at I mean, it takes place at
At
Camden
Camden,
fictionally, but it takes place, but it's yes, it's meant to be Bennington College.
and Clay is in it. It's where he first begins the characters that reappear in every book.
And Patrick Bateman's younger brother is one of the main characters. Patrick is mentioned.
Shawn Bateman is one of the main characters
Oh, Sean Bateman. I was thinking Jason Bateman because Jason Bateman is an actor, but Sean Bateman is the character in The Rules of Attraction. Patrick Bateman is his brother, who was mentioned as being like maybe having also graduated Bennington. I can't remember, but being a finance guy that lives in New York.
There's a part of the book where Shawn Bateman is take gets called out for a phone call in the hallway with his brother Patrick Bateman about meeting their father for the dinner in New York or something like that. And then Patrick Bateman goes on to be the main character in American Psycho, and Shawn Bateman appears in that. Characters from this book reappear in Bennington. Vaden or Vanden, the character who does not appear in Less Than Zero, but she is mentioned by
Oh, she's mentioned
his
by
friend
his.
from Bennington who lives in LA also, that he might have gotten her pregnant. She's in Rules of Attraction and some other books, but these characters keep repeating. Clay is in Rules of Attraction briefly. Characters from that then appear in American Psycho. Characters from Rules of Attraction and American Psycho then appear in Glamorama. At one point, he even starts bringing characters from Jay McInerney's books into his books. Like he just adopts some of them and starts writing about them as though they're care as like just keeps the character and puts them into his books. And Rules of Attraction doesn't do as well as this one did, but it's a better book in my opinion. It's I think my favorite Bret Easton Ellis book. I like the stream of consciousness. He ramps that up from this one to that one, much like you would imagine a guy in
Yeah,
college
it's a
who just
little
had to read
more.
James Joyce might do. And I
It's a I you know I was actually going to compare it to On the Road by Jack Kerouac.
Yeah, but all of these things are like present in it, like the sort of influences that a young literary guy would have at a far out liberal
In
arts
the
college in the
80s.
woods in New Hampshire. Actually, I think Bennington is technically in Vermont. I think Camden is in New Hampshire. I think Bennington's in Vermont.
I can Google it.
Rules of Attraction does fine. So then in 1991, he releases American Psycho, which is,
Bennington is in Vermont,
yeah.
correct?
He releases American Psycho, which is everything about this book amplified. It's three times as long. The stream of consciousness is used to his best effect, I think, for like the best effect of stream of consciousness I think that I've seen I don't know, in any kind of modern book. I mean, it's not like a heavily used style, but it's readable and it's addictive to read it in American Psycho. He ramps up the violence. He ramps up the gore, the sex, the derealization, the nihilism, the being disaffected by life. And I think that book still works. American Psycho.
It's a great book. I don't want to reread it ever again, personally.
The thing to do is to reread parts of it.
Maybe, yeah. To sit down and read the whole thing again feels like something I don't need, that I don't need in my life. I've read the book, I've seen the movie. I have deeply vivid memories of the book, and I read it probably 15 years ago.
The book, it's interesting to read it and not read the murder parts. It's still an interesting book without the murder. It's also quick,
That
it's also way
is
shorter.
also a lot shorter. You're not going into detailed scenes of sex and violence.
Yeah, no, they go on for pages and pages, but it's actually kind of interesting to read it and skip the murder parts and just read the derealized nihilistic like finance guy of the 80s like slowly coming unraveled as he realizes like the world that he has created and is a part of is like meaningless and has like absolutely no lasting value. Still works. Then he does Lunar Park. Oh no, actually, then he does Glamorama. That's a piece of
Ugh,
shit.
we don't even need to talk about Glamorama. That
That's
was an
his
absolute
favorite.
piece of shit.
Oh, it's an
Well,
absolute,
that's terrible. That was an absolute piece of
absolute piece
garbage.
of dog shit. His favorite book. And he's like, I think of like, I read an interview with him in the Paris Review where he's like, I think amongst my fans, the ones who really get me, like, that's the one they realize is like the best of like what I put out there. I'm like, that book sucks, brother. I'm sorry. It's awful.
Yeah, I feel like that book is just the only one that takes like a slight turn, maybe. That doesn't quite it's not I hated it.
It's
I
so
don't know.
dumb.
Actually, no, I can't even speak to it. I can't like I feel like I read it and then I made you read it because it was like, is this book terrible or did I miss something? And then you read it and we're like, nah, this is terrible.
No, it's
And then
a
I
guy from
shut
Rules
and
of
then I
Attraction
like
gets involved with an international cabal of high fashion models who also commit crimes and
Spies
assassins.
or
Yeah, they're
something?
spies and they do assassinations.
Assassins?
And then Zoolander came out in his book funnier, better, and just a more enjoyable piece of media to begin with, a more enjoyable piece of media in every respect.
Somebody read Glamorama and was like, well, we could actually make this good.
No,
Called
I
Ben
feel like Ben
Stiller, now we
Stiller
have
and Justin
Zoolander.
Theroux were like, what if we just made this funny instead of this?
What if we made this
Yeah.
funny instead of Glamorama?
Then he does Lunar Park, which I, in my mind, is where I kind of stop. Like, I like the Bret Easton. That's sort of, I imagine that that's where it's over, is Lunar Park, and that it doesn't go on from there.
And then there was Imperial Bedrooms.
Which is a sequel to Less Than Zero and is fine. I don't know.
The Informers, which I don't remember enjoying.
Collection of short stories that
Oh, the
are,
collection of short stories that
yeah.
are more of the some kind of more of the same, I guess, like.
They're an interesting exercise in style, but like, if you want to be a completionist, they're Bret Easton Ellis, they're fine, but I don't, they're whatever. Imperial Bedrooms is also fine. It's a sequel to this, and it's Clay's back in LA and he's a screenwriter now. Whatever. It's more of this. He still he's he people are still afraid to merge. He still disappears here. All that. It doesn't
He's
it, it
just
does it doesn't
an adult now.
it doesn't plow any new fields or expand the world in any meaningful way. But then comes the shards, which there's a long way to get there, but the first version of Less Than Zero was like a bloated young person's like on and on and on and on and on, kind of novel about like his world. And Joe McGinnis saved it, cut it back, and Bret Easton Ellis, of course, worked with him and like made this classic. And then I don't know what, like 4 or 5 years ago, he just, I guess, started thinking to himself, but what if that thing that happened that made me famous and made an incredible book, what if it didn't happen and we just left the bloated, what if I dug up this corpse and it was even more bloated and even longer and even or more
What if I
nihilistic.
rewrote less than zero, but instead of it being good, it wasn't?
It's one of those things that really, like, it's. I hope he likes it. I don't care. I don't wish any harm to Bryce Donnell. Oh, Bryce Donnell is kind of a chode, but he is. I read his book of essays called White. That's a lot of. I wish it was more interesting. I wish it was a more interesting take, but it's a lot of, like, kids these days, just they're too sensitive. Like, dude, that's. I expect you to at least be original, Bret Easton Ellis, and not to just sound like, I don't know, every old person from ever.
I want some Gen X nihilism, not some like hot take, not some boomerish hot take.
And I mean, we blame the boomers just because they're still around at the moment, but every old person has thought the younger generation
Every
was
old
too.
person
That's
has
the.
thought the youngest
It
generation
is.
was too something or
It's the
other. Yeah.
lamest take he could have possibly had. And he wrote a whole book of essays just making that his, like, new persona is that, everyone's too worked up about Trump and, like, these snowflakes, they don't have a work ethic. No one wants to work anymore. And, like, they just want it handed to them. Shut, dude. You used
Brett,
to,
seriously, go back to doing cocaine off
yeah, you were
boogers.
cool at one point, man. What are you doing? I just the saddest old man thing you've ever seen. And it hurt me a little bit to see him turn into that. But the shards is he just it's so long that you just realize there's absolutely nothing in here. It means nothing. It's just long, meandering descriptions of driving up Mulholland. How did you
Yes.
describe it? Like, just like riding around. It's just like reading part of it was just like, it's just Waze giving the directions out loud for like 50
Oh, yeah,
pages.
no. It's like if I was listening, if it's like listening to Waze give you directions and then in between descriptions of Bret Easton Ellis masturbating, which is not something I need to read about at all, probably, and definitely not every few pages. Like there's a lot of that in it, which was also just like, this is. I could do with less of this.
It also supposedly is like around, like, I don't know, a serial killer that like never really materializes. It doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. Nothing
No,
about.
it has a little like a, I mean, the American Psycho ending was good when it was the American Psycho ending. Like I said, I mean, this book has a little bit of an echo of a little bit of a foreshadowing for that, right? Like that he's, part of the reason, like I said, that we're able to get this like sort of straightforward, factual, sort of non-judgmental take on what's happening in LA when he comes back from college is because like he's so withdrawn. He's not really there. He's just kind of floating through like this ghost that that everybody knows. No one can connect with him. And then we have that same kind of thing. And in the end of American Psycho, we do have it as this like actual twist of like, yeah, man, you didn't do all that stuff.
Just
You're
one.
just a guy who wears Armani and notices what everybody else is wearing. You know what I
You're
love
just an
about Bret Easton
you're just an
Ellis?
American psycho,
Yeah.
just one of those good old American
American
psychos.
psychos. Something I love about Bret Easton Ellis writing, I love how much he loves to talk about what people are wearing.
All of those things work for me until they don't, until Glamorama and until.
But it was a thing I really loved in American
The
Psycho is how much they're
shards.
talking about like what they're wearing, what they're wearing and what brands they are, and everybody's like their business cards and like what kind of business cards they got and what the mine has this like raised font on it, and I got, eggshell. It's like, well, mine's, half and half cream, or I don't know, whatever their stupid white colors are,
No,
talking
and
about
in American
their business
Psycho, again,
cards. I like those like.
it works for the book. It works for the piece of fiction to like have all of this like listed and like it goes on and on, and it contributes to the overall theme, tone, and characterization going on within that novel. And then in The Shards, it feels like a guy covering his own songs, I suppose, is what happened in that one. Or I guess just Bret Easton Ellis got old, if we can like judge from the previous book of essays, White. I think even I think now that I'm realizing I'm saying the name out loud, I realize I think there's also one in there about how being woke is reverse racism or something like that. Like
Oh, I can't. Oh, that's, yeah.
it's all the hits. It's all the hits. Like the snowflakes don't want to work. Everyone wants a handout. Something is reverse racism. It's all of that.
It's an old rich white guy writing.
You'd think he was like 75. He's not that old, but like it's
Yeah, I mean, at least he was a young rich white guy when he was coming out with this stuff, when he was coming out with some of these other things.
an embarrassing book. Like it's I can't.
I'm embarrassed just hearing about it. I'm
Yeah.
embarrassed for you for having had to read it. That sounds terrible.
I couldn't look away. Like I don't know. It's like I just kept going. I was like, I can't. There has to be something else in here. And like, nope. He's just a boring, unsurprising white guy with, I'm not just, I don't know, like uninteresting takes that aren't original. It's just he's un he turned he became unoriginal.
So
Do you want to do one
we
stars?
want to. I want to talk. Yes, let's do our Goodreads segment. What people liked and did not like about this novel, about Less Than Zero.
You won't be surprised at all to know that the things that people hate about this book are also the things that other people absolutely love about it. It's got a little bit of the sellout quality to it, where one person's in crazy, incredible stylistic journey through literature is another person's absolute slog through meaninglessness. So, chief complaint over and over and over again is nothing happens. And while that's true that there are stretches of this book where you are just hanging out with the characters and meandering through parts of LA and going to bars and clubs and shows, nothing happens is a wild take, in my opinion, because there's a like a 19-year-old kid being pimped out to pay back a debt generated by like a huge amount of drug use. We go to one of the John's hotel rooms, then we go to a party where we see it doesn't it's either at the party, I can't remember if it's before or after, but at one point the pimp holds Julian down and just injects him with heroin to calm him down.
Oh yeah. At the party. No, there
There's a
it, I mean,
snuff
like we
film,
talked about, there was a snuff film.
there's a gang
There was the
rape.
scene with the 12-year-old, which is incredibly upsetting.
Yeah, no, there's the dead body. There's like it's terrible things, but stuff definitely happens in this book.
Yes, things definitely happen in this book.
Second most brought up complaint is that the dialogue goes nowhere. I get that. Like you and I talked about it. I like it. You like it?
I mean, I think it's the point of the, it's what he's trying to show in the book.
Yes, no,
That's what this book
I think
is,
it
you know,
works and I
it
think it's
is, yeah, I think
effective
it
and I
works.
think it's fun to read. And I enjoyed it, but I do get as like a casual reader, if you pick this up and you're not looking for a immersive stylistic experience, you might be like, what's with this porno dialogue?
Yeah, I mean,
It's actually, I can see someone being like, this is like below porno dialogue, because porno dialogue at least eventually leads to the porno part of the porno. This just leads to people going back to their car and driving home.
Right.
It doesn't even usually lead to the porno parts.
And, right. No, it doesn't. Yeah. It just leads to, it's just awkward conversations and then they go home.
No, sometimes a person like
Sometimes with each other and we don't even get to hear about the sex.
sometimes a person borrows a sweater.
That vest.
It's like
It was a vest.
a
And
sweater vest.
somehow he really wants that vest back.
It is really funny every now and again when like you pay attention to like when he actually describes the clothes that people wear and you realize that there was this hard smash cut to like everyone dressing like crap in America, but like these kids are wearing ties when they go out, like they're dressing.
They're really dressed up. Yeah.
And I don't even think it's just because they're like wealthy kids in LA. You can look at like
No,
the
there, you're
photo
right that
record of
there is just kind
America.
of a smash cut to like we all started dressing more casually.
And then it keeps going until you hit Crocs, until you hit like, UFC t-shirts.
Yeah, maybe this is what brought us to Crocs.
No, just athleisure wear, like this entire like sad sartorial state the country finds itself in today, where like you just, I don't know, you walk around and there's a grown man in the mall in a Minions t-shirt, and like he doesn't realize that he should just go home, turn off the lights, close the blinds, and quit. Like it's over, brother. What are you doing?
All right. What are the good read? What are the 5-star good
Wait, sorry.
reads?
I have one
What
more.
do they have to say? Oh wait, what else do we got for the 1 stars? All right.
The other common refrain is that this is that it is meaningless, that it's pseudo-intellectual nihilism that doesn't actually mean anything. It's posing as being meaningful through its disaffected approach to the story, but that it's actually just nothing. It's smoke and mirrors. There is no actual larger meaning to it. And I can also get that. Like
I mean, yeah, that is a, I mean, that is one way, I guess, that is one way to read this.
I
Yeah.
like this book, but I understand not liking it.
I understand not liking this book as well. It, he pushed, I mean, he pushes buttons, and I think that's something that makes this book, I think that's part of, and people respond to that. You know what I mean? You want, like, when something comes out and a lot of people love it and a lot of people hate it, that's what makes something good. Like when something comes out and everybody just like loves it, it does lose a little something, right? I mean, like it's good, but like
No, I think, I mean,
if you can't.
controversy has been Bret Easton Ellis's friend as far as the like notoriety and like popularity of his work.
I mean, and by something being controversial, I guess that's not what makes something good. That's what makes something famous.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Right?
No,
Like
that's yes, of course.
That's what makes something famous. That's what makes something popular. That's what puts something on the map. That's not necessarily what makes something good. Forrest Gump is a very good movie that people really like. You know what I mean? It's a good movie. I don't know. Does somebody hate Forrest Gump? You can write and tell us if you hated Forrest Gump and
I
why.
think
But
lots of people
I've
hate
never.
Forrest Gump. I would
People
say,
hate Forrest Gump?
I would say for
I hate
I would say
Jenny.
Forrest Gump is also more closely related to this book than you're remembering. You're remembering the feel good parts of it. Forrest Gump is a very dark film, and it's
Yeah, it's a good,
sort
yes,
of
that's,
wild that it was as beloved as it
yeah,
was.
that's what, yeah, but like, that's also again, like, that's what makes it
Yeah.
good. It's not just that it's not just a feel good movie, right? Like, he's a feel good guy that we like, but like, he goes through all of this stuff. No, I'm remembering Forrest Gump. I was there in Nam in Forrest Gump.
Oh, I was thinking of like the part where Jenny,
I was there in the New Year's Eve scene with Lieutenant Dan, or where
the
Jenny.
part where Jenny sexually pleasures a mentally challenged fellow in her dorm room in front of her roommate, and then lets him finish on her sweater, and then says out loud, "I don't like her anyway." Just sort of like that's in this movie. What? That's in this movie. That's a wild. That's a crazy scene.
Yeah, that is a wild scene,
No, I made it the controversy, I
but my
think, has
point
made
being, like,
more people
but people
read
really
his,
like it, right?
yes, I think the controversy
But
around
controversy
Bret
is
Easton
what makes
Ellis
something
has
famous.
made more people read his work than maybe would have read a 20-year-old guy's debut novel in 1985, some guy still in college.
Right. All right. F 50 Shades of Grey. People read that because it was like, I read it because it was the worst thing I've legitimately ever read. Like, I could not believe how terrible those books
Oh, it
were
was so terrible you had to read all three.
that I had to read all three of them. 100%. I've never read worse garbage in my life. And it was like hilarious and like a fun read. And that was part of the reason I read it. I also went to go see all three movies. Don't come at me. I'm fine. I took canned wine and they were hilarious.
Can't believe you.
They were so terrible that I super enjoyed them. I cannot believe something so bad was
I'm
published.
still to this day more surprised that you read all three of them. Like
I've
I'm
100% read all three of
mostly
them. They were
surprised
so
that you
bad.
read the third one. Like I understand going for the second one just to see like what how could this possibly have a sequel, but the third one is the one where I'm sort of like, don't, what are you doing?
Yeah, no, then they're married. I had to know. She marries this guy. I gotta read it. She gets kidnapped. This is, I couldn't,
Do they have a kid?
I've legitimately, yeah, they do in the end. Yeah. But then they're still into S&M.
Son of 50 Shades then, or daughter of 50 Shades. There's more. It's a legacy sequel could be in the works.
I'm probably done. I think the three was enough. But again, that was something that was famous. It was not good. There are people who like it. There are people, I have heard people say that those were good books. And it's like, well, that they're not. You're wrong, but that's okay. If you enjoyed this, I'm not going to hate on it. I still read them.
Like I said, I understand how someone could think that this was like empty nihilism that doesn't mean anything and is just there for like shock and awe. But like, I do think that this one in particular of his books has a little enough of an undercurrent of residual emotion from when Clay was younger, from when Clay remembers back to other times, when he flashes back to Julian at 9 years old playing soccer with him at school, when he reminisces about the times his family would spend out in Palm Desert or Springs or one of the Palm places, that can put a little weight to the emptiness that the characters are feeling on the page, like for the rest of the time.
I also kind of think that's why those flashbacks are there. And there's a flashback about his grandmother that's incredibly sweet.
Yes. Yeah.
It's page 163, and my note is this is like his fondest memory. This is the most love or emotion we see in the book.
Yeah.
And it's not jarring. It stands out because it's like there is this moment of connection. He is capable of feeling something.
Yeah.
Somebody in this book is capable of feeling something. There has been, there has been love. There has been some sort of emotion, in this person's life. We see this in the book.
So I prefer to read this book through a sentimental lens. That's how I like to approach it. I think that he was in love with Julian at one point, and that he is crushed a little bit by what has happened to him. And he is trying to steel himself by forcing himself to go along with Julian. He's trying to like push past his emotional connection to this like guy he was in love with. And that he is also sort of like witnessing the disillusion of his family and the like weaker man that his father is as compared to his grandfather and his grandmother and like the generation before, where he saw like where he had a stronger emotional connection to them and a little bit more respect for them as adults. That's how I prefer to read it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That is an interesting read, and I think that you're right that that's why those scenes are in the book.
Yeah, and it leaves him like unable to like really have any kind of like
And then we see
take
how
on
these
anything
kids.
else going around him. Like he's been, that's where I like
And we.
to assign, that's where the numbness has come from, is then like the world around him is like slowly letting him down over and over and over again with everything he sees.
Well, he's seeing, his. He's seeing something different in his grandparents than he sees in his parents. And then he's looking around at his friends that are being raised by these same people, right? Like, they're being raised by parents like his parents who have come from this like stronger generation and have it slowly dilutes down with all of this money, right? That these people sort of have like less emotion, less work ethic, less ability to connect with each other. They're falling more and more into this sort of like numb trap, and it's worsening, right? It's dementing sort of with each generation.
And I think there's lots of ways to read this one. Like I feel like this is, I feel like one of the strengths of this is that you can put a couple of interpretations on it. And I think any of them could be accurate.
Do we want to do? I don't have a lot of quotes
I
because,
don't have a lot of quotes either because this is not a really,
this isn't a quotable book. Yes, I mean, I have one.
go.
He's over at Trent's house, and Trent's been on the phone with his coke dealer,
Okay.
trying to get his coke dealer to, I don't know, bring him coke, I guess. The phone rings again. Jesus, Trent yells, sitting up, grabbing the telephone and screaming into it. I don't even want your lousy fucking coke. He pauses for a moment and then says, "Yeah, I'll be right down." He hangs the phone up and looks at me. Who was it? My mother. She's calling from downstairs. And that's just such a cliched, like, that's just such a cliched thing, right? Like, that's just such like a little like trope, I feel like, in like movies and stuff. But I really enjoyed that. And his mom doesn't even comment on it, right? Like, just like, oh,
The
I'm down. She just wants to tell him that she's like leaving. She's drinking her tab downstairs, smoking a cigarette, wants to tell him she's leaving for a party or something. No comment. No comment, no care that her kid, that her 18-year-old son is like buying cocaine.
I mean, I do reading this, I don't think this book is realistic. Like, I don't think that this is what Bret Easton Ellis' friends were like when he was younger. Like, I think this is highly, highly exaggerated. I don't think people are like this, and I don't think rich teenagers are like this. Like, I'm sure somebody listening to this is going to be like, I knew a guy. Maybe you knew one guy, but like, I just don't think as like a group, this grim view of like all humanity holds true.
No, and I think that that's probably it, this is probably speaking a little bit more about like a generation or a group of people. And I mean, he's lumping it together into this particular group of friends for the purpose of the novel. But I think this is maybe just like a more nihilistic kind of jaded view, generally speaking. But like, yes, I don't think that probably all of his friends were this terrible.
This is a quote that I wrote down because I was going to talk about it, but I'll do it now. But it was I was going to talk about it when I talked about how some of the tells about this being written by a young person. It was all it comes down to is the fact that I'm a boy coming home for a month and meeting someone whom I haven't seen for 4 months, and people are afraid to merge. A good line in the context of the novel.
Sums things up.
Yes, it also sort of encompasses both the motif of people being afraid to merge and the lack of connection, which I think is good. And it also sort of points to the immaturity of the writer, of the like just a boy coming home and talking to someone I haven't seen in 4 months. Like that's when you're younger, that seems like a very long time. But particularly when you're college age and you're going to college, that's like a totally regular thing. So don't have a lot of quotes for this one. Let's talk about what we're going to read next.
Yes, because somebody we did not talk about when we were kind of discussing some of his influences, him hanging out with Jay McInerney, that he went to school with another famous writer. He's rubbing elbows with somebody else who's a famous writer, Donna Tartt.
Yeah,
So also a Bennington graduate.
this Bennington class that he's a part of has, so he meets Jay McInerney just like in the world as a writer, but his Bennington class that he is a part of has him, Donna Tartt, Jonathan Lethem, and Jill Eisenstadt. She wrote several books, I think. All of them were in Bennington at the same time, and they've all had substantial impact. Like in their books, Jill's the one I'm least familiar with, and maybe she has not quite had the lasting literary trail that the other ones have. But Donna Tartt, I think, won the Pulitzer a few years ago for The Goldfinch. The Secret History is fantastic and a great book. Lethem has gotten several awards, and
Motherless Brooklyn.
that's the one that I like.
That's the one I
I
like
didn't
too.
enjoy Fortress of Solitude, but I know that it was well received and people did enjoy it. Less so for me, but Motherless Brooklyn was good. But
Yes, I enjoyed that as well. So we are going to be doing. So we're going to. So we've talked about because we've bashed on Bret Easton Ellis a fair amount in this podcast, and so, so we want to. So we did want to do one of his well received book and
let's do.
In my opinion, certainly one of the best. But so we want to talk about his influences a little
Yeah.
bit for our next. So we're doing a tiny series here based on Brett. And so our next book, Kennedy, will be.
Play It As It Lays by Joan Didion, which is, and again, he has talked about this, but like the book that you can very much imagine he read and was like, I want to do this. I want to write a book like this about me and my world and my life.
And that is definitely, yes, play it as it lays. So we're
Yeah.
going to, and also, I mean, can we do a literary podcast without talking about Joan
No,
Didion? I couldn't.
she's the
I
queen.
wouldn't. I wouldn't. She's a queen. And so we're gonna, so we're gonna discuss her novel.
This will be the first fiction of hers I've read. I've only ever read her nonfiction.
Oh, really?
I've never read any of her fiction. I've gone through all the books of essays, not for a particular reason, but I think I guess in my head I've just categorized her as the essayist that I read.
As an essayist,
Yeah.
yeah, I mean that is more. I mean that is more what she's known for is her journalism. But yes, we'll be doing Play It As It Lays, and then we will be following up Play It As It Lays with Donna Tartt.
The Secret History.
So we're going to discuss, one of Bret Easton Ellis's influences, with Joan Didion, and then a colleague or a classmate, someone he was rubbing elbows with, and we'll discuss their relationship a little bit. Their working relationship, as it were, when we get to The Secret History. So that's what you have to look forward to. The Secret History is long, so you can fly through Play It As It Lays and then kind of plow through The Secret History along with us, and then we will be discussing that.
And then we'll see what books we can tease out of those two that we'll do afterwards. All right. So that was Lesson Zero. As always, you can write to us at readingpopclassics@gmail.com. Tell us what you think about the podcast, if it's nice. Tell us books you think we should do. And Rebecca, where can you follow us on Instagram?
At Reading Pop Classics.
All right. So thank you very much for listening. Please subscribe. It helps the podcast, and have a good one.
And thanks for listening.